One can only appreciate the sea change brought about in 1965 if one understands what happened in 665, in 965, and in 1265. This is one of the fundamental points that I'm going to want to convey in the course of this lecture series. What is not necessarily what was. We could only understand the is if we understand the was. The contemporary world, with all of its nuance and complexity, can only be appreciated if one is aware of important aspects of the medieval world. You expelled us, we're back, and we're still here. Jews have a propensity to refer to countries and to geographic areas by using biblical names. And so, for whatever reason that still remains somewhat unclear, the name Ashkenaz, which appears in the 10th chapter of the book of Genesis, came first to refer to Jews who were living in Northwest Europe, what later became Germany and Northern France and England, and as those Jews moved eastward, to refer to Jews who were living in Eastern and in Central Europe. The name Sfarad, which appears in the book of Ovadia, there's actually only one chapter in the entire book of Ovadia, came to refer to Jews who were living in Southwest Europe, what becomes Spain, Portugal, and later, as those Jews moved eastward, to Jews living in the Ottoman Empire, Turkey, Greece, and the Holy Land. The earliest evidence that we have of Jews in Ashkenaz, in Germany in particular, comes from the 4th century. There's more in the 6th century, and by the 8th century, we already have several small Jewish communities in that area. In the year 771, Charlemagne assumed power, and on Christmas Day in the year 800, he was crowned emperor by the Pope. The Jewish situation under Charlemagne was relatively positive. They were merchants, they were traders, and they had various protections that were offered them and afforded them by ruling authorities. Jewish communities began appearing in various growing urban centers, especially along the Rhine River, northwest of what is today Germany. And three major cities, which will figure very prominently in the early history of Jews in Ashkenaz, Speyer, Worms, and Mainz, along the Rhine River. Speyer is southernmost, going south to north, Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. Their status was so positive that in 1084, when Rüdiger, who was the bishop of Speyer, wanted to build up his city, he invited Jews to settle there, and I quote, "In the name of the holy and undivided Trinity, when I wish to make a city out of the village of Speyer, I, Rüdiger, bishop of Speyer, thought," now listen to these words, "that the glory of our town would be augmented 1,000-fold if I were to bring in the Jews. The Jews are special, the Jews are important. You want to build up a town, you want to turn a town into a city, you're going to invite the Jews." But it didn't take long, and very shortly thereafter, the pendulum began to shift and shifted to an extreme. Some 11 years later, in November of 1095, Pope Urban II called for a crusade in the town of Clermont in southern France to liberate the holy city of Jerusalem from the Muslims, who had ruled over that city for roughly around the last half a millennia or so. More on this in my next lecture. Various factors at that time converged, leading the church to take an active role in wanting to bring this holy city of Jerusalem under Christian control. The city is very important for Christians. Jesus taught in Jerusalem. Jesus ministered in Jerusalem. Jesus was crucified in Jerusalem. The resurrection happened from Jerusalem. Very important. And for all kinds of reasons, now is the time when Christendom felt that it's necessary to have their own ownership over this city, that it's an embarrassment that another religion has control over this city. And so the Pope calls for a crusade, and ultimately they were successful. It took them about 3.5 years to make their way from southern France all the way across Europe, all the way to the Middle East. And in 1099, they conquered Jerusalem and held onto Jerusalem for roughly around a little bit more than 100 years. When the news spread of the Pope's call, French Jewry was terrified by this eruption of armed Christendom, which they fully expected would place them in mortal danger. We now know already about the attitude of classical Christianity to Jews and to Judaism. Armed Christendom is a real danger for Jews, and they were panic-stricken. They wrote to their German co-religionists living further north, seeking assistance. We don't have that letter, but we do have a record of the response from Germany, and I quote, "When the letters reached the saints, the men of renown, the pillars of the universe in Mainz," when the letters from the French Jews came to Germany, came to what later becomes Germany, we came to the Rhineland, when came to the city of Mainz, they wrote to the land of France saying, so here's the record of the response, "All the communities in the Rhineland have decreed a fast day. We have done our duty. We are greatly concerned about your well-being. As for ourselves, there is no great cause for fear. We haven't heard a word of such matters, nor has it been hinted that our lives are being threatened by the sword. Our heart breaks for you. We're sorry for you. We're sorry to hear that you're in trouble. We feel for you. We're praying for you. We're doing whatever we can to help you. But as far as we're concerned, it's all good. Around here, it's fine. We're your brothers. We're invested in you, but we're okay." Turns out, ironically, that French Jewry that was so worried emerges relatively unscathed, while German Jewry that felt so secure suffered terrible losses. A 12th century Jewish chronicler reports, and I quote, "As they," reference here to the Crusaders, "passed through the towns where there were Jews, they," the Crusaders, "said to one another, 'We are going on a distant journey, namely, we're going way far to the Holy Land. We're going to Israel to exact vengeance on the Ishmaelites. Yet here are Jews dwelling in our midst, whose forefathers slew him," him is a reference to Jesus, "and crucified him without reason. First, let us take vengeance on them and destroy them as a people. Why am I traveling for 3.5 years to go fight with people who are not Christians? Right here in my backyard, I have non-Christians who really deserve to be punished. After all, they're the ones who killed Jesus. They're the ones who are responsible for the crucifixion." And that's exactly what happened. In the spring of 1096, the Crusaders, as they're merging out of southern France, they take a little bit of a detour, they go into Germany, and they attack many Jewish communities in Germany, most notably the cities of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. We don't know exactly how many Jews are killed. It's impossible. There are no fancy records. There's no way how to determine numbers in pre-modern times. The latest scholarly estimate is there were 3,000 Jews who were killed in various communities in the Rhine Valley and in what is later known as Germany during the time of the Crusades. Whenever one confronts what in hindsight turns out to be an incredible miscalculation of reality, and I want you to take a moment and think about Jews in Spain in the 15th century before the expulsion of 1492, more on that later, and even more directly relevant to our times, Jews who were living in Germany in the 1930s. Think about that for a moment. Whenever one confronts what later turns out to be, oh my God, I can't believe what were they thinking, we have to ask ourselves, and the same thing is happening now, German Jewry says, we're good to go, and then 5 minutes later they get destroyed. We have to ask ourselves whether those who were living then refused to see what was obvious, and they deluded themselves, whether consciously or unconsciously, into thinking everything is fine, or whether maybe there was an objective basis or a justification for their rather optimistic assessment, that they had legitimate grounds to assume that at the end of the day, we're going to be okay. And indeed, the status of pre-Crusade Jewish life in Germany is the subject of much discussion and debate. So what's really going on in the 11th century in that part of the world? The consensus is that while the situation was not always good, and it could not be good for Jews living under Christendom, it's never good. I talked last time in the last lecture about this balance between you have to somehow keep them alive, but you have to keep them alive in a degraded state. So it's not really good, but it wasn't really so bad. It was never so bad as to have prepared the Jews then for what actually did happen. And again, think about Spanish Jews in the 15th century and German Jewry in the 1930s. We have a number of Crusade chronicles, so-called Crusade chronicles, that were written some 50 to 60 years after the end of these massacres. They're written in the middle of the 12th century, which purport to describe the events that occurred. In fact, the Crusades is the most chronicled of all events in medieval Jewish history. The objective historical value of these documents is the subject of much debate. They were not historians. They don't write objective history. They're writing with an angle. They want to write to convey a particular message. And they certainly do provide, even if they're not objectively historical, you can't write a history exactly of what happened based on these texts, but they do provide a very important set of insights into the mindset of the Jews who were experiencing what occurred to them at that time. They make it clear, for example, that the Jews were given a choice by the Crusaders. The choice is, if you convert, you're okay. We're not going to kill you. If you don't want to convert, then the punishment is death, then we are going to kill you. If you want to persist in maintaining your Jewish identity, we're going to kill you, but you have an out. Convert to Christianity and you will be saved. And remarkably, under those circumstances, most, not all, most chose death. And more remarkably, the sources show, as do other documents, that the Jews didn't just allow themselves passively to be killed. They weren't just passive martyrs, allowed the Crusaders to come and to kill them, but they actually killed themselves proactively. They committed suicide. And most remarkably, the sources show, confirmed by other sources, both Jewish and Christian, that not only did they commit suicide, but they actually committed murder. They killed their children. They killed one another to ensure that none of them should fall into Crusader hands. It's hard for a 21st century human being to imagine such a thing. They were afraid that if that happened, if they fell into Crusader hands, they would in all likelihood be forcibly converted to Christianity, and that was a fate that they could not possibly begin to contemplate. That was absolutely off the table, and particularly their children. They were afraid that if the children would be captured and taken by the Crusaders, they would be raised as Christians, and that for them was absolutely horrific and unacceptable. The sources record that the Jews then engaged in what I call a paroxysm of self-immolation. Hard to imagine. Martyrdom. There's an out. Convert. Convert, and maybe someday you'll come back. You don't really mean it. Martyrdom, suicide, and even murder. There's a lot of discussion in the sources. How do we justify murder? Murder requires, where do you have a permission to murder somebody? Okay, martyrdom. If somebody tells somebody to violate the big three terrible sins, adultery, idolatry, and murder, so you have to allow yourself to be killed. Allow yourself to be killed. Suicide? Murder? It's shocking. It's striking. And it's really hard to explain. This leads to a very interesting observation. The Crusade Chronicles are particularly significant because they represent a rare phenomenon in history. And now by history, I mean even general history. Usually, the victor records history. The defeated are mute, inarticulate. The defeated leave no literary remains. But here, the defeated write. I told you that the Crusades are the most well-known. We have so much information written by Jews about the Crusades. But they didn't write as the defeated. They raised their story to a high, momentous, triumphalist level as if they were the victors. Obviously, Christianity was ascendant, but these Crusade Chronicles seek to reclaim a central position of power for the Jews. They go to great lengths to show they were not just passive, they were active. They were actively engaged in determining their own destiny. The one who kills the most is not the winner. The real winner is the one who dramatically gives up one's life for God, who commits suicide and even murder for God, who heroically maintains faith in God, even under the most difficult circumstances. The Crusade Chronicles tell a Jewish story with incredible power and vigor and pathos. It's a story of active heroes, not passive bystanders. It's a story of victors and not victims. After the Crusades, the Jewish situation in Northwest Europe deteriorates, and I will return to this in a future presentation. I want to now move to the extraordinary intellectual achievements of medieval Ashkenazi Jewry. But first, a word of introduction. In the ancient world, there were two primary Jewish communities, in the land of Israel, Eretz Yisrael, and in Babel or Babylonia. In fact, there were two different versions of the Talmud that were produced. We have what is known as the Talmud Yerushalmi, or the Jerusalem or Palestinian Talmud, and we have the Talmud Bavli, or the Babylonian Talmud. For a long time, the scholarly consensus was that these two major European centers of Jewry, Ashkenazim and Sfardim, each drew their cultural heritage from these two centers respectively. Ashkenazi Jews were thought to derive their cultural heritage, their mores, from Palestine. What happened? Jews were living in Palestine. Rome is responsible for the destruction of the Second Temple. They capture the Jews, they bring them to Italy. And as we'll see shortly, Jews from Italy were invited to go north into Germany. So Ashkenazi Jews come from Eretz Yisrael, come from Palestine via Italy to Germany, Ashkenazi Jews. And by contrast, Sephardi Jews were understood, this is the consensus for a long time, to be heirs of the Babylonian Jewish cultural tradition. More on the Sephardi story later. Recently, this assumption has been the subject of substantial scholarly discussion and analysis. And in any case, wherever they come from, it's important to make the point that the sharpness of this cultural dichotomy should not be overstated, Ashkenazim and Sephardim. We have an enormous amount of evidence that throughout the Middle Ages, there are what I call cross-cultural fertilizations, connections between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. So however they begin, wherever they come from, whatever their origins, and however they do not develop in isolation from one another. These are living here, these are living there. Yes, it's true, they're different ethnic identities, but the interconnections are strong and meaningful and very significant. Intellectual Jewish life in the Rhineland, or Ashkenaz, began at the turn of the 11th century when the Kalonymus family was invited to settle there. They were a very prominent Italian Jewish family, known mostly for their greatness in producing liturgical poetry. They're invited from Italy to come to Ashkenaz, to come to Germany, and they provide communal and spiritual leadership for the nascent Jewish community that was developing there. Intellectual, serious, indigenous Jewish life begins in the next generation. And that's pretty much a rule in history. The first generation that somebody shows up somewhere, they're not busy thinking all kinds of intellectual thoughts. They have to find out where the grocery store is. They have to find out where the cemetery is. They have to find seeds to go plant something. They have to build a house of worship. They have to find where the pencil sharpener is. You have to settle yourself. You have to find a spot to live first. Then once all that is in place, oh, now you could begin to think high thoughts and to devote your attention to intellectual pursuits. But it's only in the third generation when intellectual Jewish life in Ashkenaz really begins to come into its own. The major figure, the second half of the 10th into the 11th century, was Rabbeinu Gershom, Rabbeinu, our master Gershom, known for posterity by the title of Maor HaGolah, which means light of the exile. Gives you a sense of how prominent he was perceived to be by subsequent generations. Rabbeinu, our teacher, our master Gershom, that was his name, Maor HaGolah, he brings light to the entire exile. Rabbeinu Gershom was a very prominent and influential communal leader who assumed authority by the sheer force of his personality. You understand, it wasn't like there was a position that he took that intrinsically gave him authority. There was nothing going on there yet. There were no positions. There was no official community. But by the force of his own personality, he became the leader of the community. He founded and he headed a yeshiva, an institution for higher Jewish learning in Mainz. He wrote responsa, essays responding to various questions in Jewish law that he was asked. He wrote commentaries on the Talmud, and he wrote liturgical poetry. And he provided an organizational structure for the scattered, growing, small number of Jewish communities in the area, bringing them together in synods, S-Y-N-O-D-S, or conferences to deal with common issues that they faced. But he is most well-known, Rabbeinu Gershom is, for a series of enactments which are identified with him, the Takanot, enactments of Rabbeinu Gershom, which continue to have influence down to contemporary times. For example, Rabbeinu Gershom imposed strict obligations on a husband to support his wife. He prohibited a man from being married to more than one woman. He prohibited a man from divorcing his wife against her will. He protected the privacy of the male. Now, today we take some of these for granted, but we're looking at 1,000 years ago when they were path-breaking and groundbreaking, and there were so many more enactments that he also promulgated. the greatest legacy of Rabbeinu Gershom with the students that he produced coming out of his yeshiva, providing leadership for subsequent generations of Jews, Jewish communities living in Ashkenaz. The next generation, the fourth generation, has the sad misfortune of being between Rabbeinu Gershom, who's the third generation, and probably the greatest Ashkenazi Jew who ever lived, and that is Rashi, who lived in the fifth generation. Rashi, acronym Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, Rabbi Shlomo, the son of Isaac, was born around the year 1040, probably not 1040, it's a little bit too neat, probably 1038, in the French town of Troyes, T-R-O-Y-E-S. At that point in France, there were no yeshivot, there were no institutions of Jewish higher learning, and in order to learn more, Rashi had to leave and had to go to the Rhineland, and he went to Worms, and he went to Mainz, and he studied in the yeshivot that were founded two generations earlier by Rabbeinu Gershom. He studies in Worms. In fact, he's so prominent in Worms that the synagogue in Worms, which was first built in the 11th century and which is still standing, is known today as the Rashi Synagogue. It was built before he got there. It's known as the Rashi Synagogue. And if you walk into the synagogue, and I was there not very long ago, there's a big wooden chair right at the front, and the guide said to me, Rashi sat in that chair. I took off my yarmulke, and I said to him, if Rashi sat in that chair, I am going to eat my yarmulke. 1,000 years ago, he sat on that chair. So you've been to Newport, Rhode Island. In Newport, Rhode Island, there's a Touro synagogue, and they say there's this chair, George Washington sat here. I could buy that. George Washington could have. How long ago was it? They held the chair, they dusted it, they kept it, they protected it. It's incredibly impossible that Rashi sat on that chair. But what does it do? You see, myths are not to be totally rejected. There's something there. There's something going on. Oh my God, Rashi was here. I'll tell you something else. In front of the shul, there's a little brick wall, and there's a little indentation in the brick wall. I was there not long ago. You're walking along, there's a brick wall. All of a sudden, the brick wall indents. So the guy says, miracle. Rashi's mom was pregnant with Rashi, and she was walking over here, and then there was a horse coming, and my God, the horse would have run her over, but God made a miracle because we had to have a Rashi. We can't destroy Rashi. So the whole wall indented. I was almost going to pull the same yarmulke story, but it's ridiculous. He wasn't born there. His mother wasn't pregnant there. But what does it do? The power of Rashi, the pride in this place. Oh my God, Rashi walked here. Lore has it that Rashi knew that his time in the yeshivot in Germany was limited. He had to get back home to Troyes. And so he was motivated to record his lectures that he heard. He took notes, and these are the notes that then served as the core for what became the most important commentary, both on the Bible and the Talmud. The most prominent and influential commentaries of Rashi came from the fact that he didn't have the rest of his life to sit there and to study. He had to hustle back. He wanted to remember what he learned, and so he took notes. Rashi's Bible commentary is the most famous and influential Jewish Bible commentary of all time. His methodology, and I want to take a moment to bring you into the world a little bit of medieval Jewish intellectual history. His methodology is described as focusing on what in Hebrew is called pshat, which is generally translated as the plain meaning or the obvious meaning or the literal meaning, as opposed to an allegorical or a homiletical meaning or interpretation of the biblical text. In one place, Rashi wrote, and I quote, just as a hammer splits a rock into many different pieces, So are there many different explanations of the biblical text, but I, however, he continued, make it my aim to explain the pshat, the plain or literal sense of Scripture. Rashi's insistence on pshat is so strong and so pronounced that he even goes so far as to interpret a biblical text even in contradiction to Jewish law. So rabbinic literature often extracts rulings from biblical verses, but he claims that that's not really what the verse means. That's how they interpreted it. But the straightforward meaning of the verse is something different. Rashi wrote elsewhere, quote, there are halachic means Jewish legal interpretations of this verse given by the sages, but the context of the wording of the text does not fit with them. And therefore, he says, I am going to interpret this text, quote, in its proper context in accordance with its literal meaning. For Rashi, an interpretation of the biblical verse stands independently of any rabbinic understanding of it. Rashi's commentary on the Bible was unbelievably and enormously influential. The very first dated, printed book in Hebrew is Rashi's commentary on the Bible, not the Bible. Rashi's commentary on the Bible, just Rashi's commentary, without the Bible, that book is the earliest dated Hebrew printed book that we have, printed in the year 1475. Not only was Rashi incredibly influential on the Jewish community, but his commentary also had great influence on Christian exegesis from the medieval period through Luther and the King James versions of the Bible. If Rashi's commentary on the Bible was the most influential biblical commentary ever, so was his commentary on the Talmud. It is this commentary, Rashi's commentary, that continues to be studied regularly. One finger on the Talmud text, one finger on Rashi, up to and including our own day. In addition to these works, Rashi also wrote responsa, which I previously defined as questions and answers, responding to questions in Jewish law that were posed to him. He had an international reputation. Questions came to him from all over, and he also wrote liturgical poetry. He's the most prominent Ashkenazi Jew of all time. His overall influence cannot possibly be overstated. Rashi was followed by a group called the Tosafists, the most prominent of whom were his own grandchildren, who flourished in Ashkenaz in the next few centuries and in the next few generations. The center of gravity is now shifting. When Rashi was growing up, nothing is going on in France. He has to go to Germany. But shortly thereafter, in Rashi's lifetime, the Crusaders come and destroy the yeshivot in Germany, and now there are yeshivot back in France again. Rashi's grandchildren presided over centers of rabbinic learning in France, no longer in Germany. We're now moving back to France. The methodology of the Tosafists was different than that of Rashi. Having recognized that the straightforward, line-by-line commentary to the Talmud was taken care of, so now we have pretty much an understanding of what this text teaches us, they composed a series of short essays. Tosafot means additions. They composed a series of essays utilizing most often the methodology of question and answer. Rashi is just a straight commentary defining words and keeping the Talmudic argumentation clear as it progresses through the text. But they're essays, questions, answers, one question, two answers, three answers, and they focus on an attempt to maintain the unity of the entire Talmudic corpus, resolving apparent contradictions between statements found in various Talmudic tractates. So they're not interested only in what's in front of you right now in this text. Well, Rashi took care of that. They're interested in, wait a minute, how can this tractate say this? So if we studied somewhere else, something else, and they see the entire Talmudic corpus as one whole, and it can't be. Oh, no, there's a contradiction. No, it's not an option. It's all one cloth, and therefore it all has to fit together, and they expend an enormous amount of energy in these essays to try to figure out a way how we could live with this. And oh, no, but it's really different. It's not really the same. It's a different story. We have to see it from a different perspective. But at the end of the day, we have this organic unity to the entire Talmudic corpus. They were also concerned with reconciling current religious practice with legal rulings. So there's something called a minhag. A minhag is a custom. Custom had the same authority as text. So just like you can't have two texts that contradict one another, so it can't be that the Jews are behaving in a particular way and doing something and that it's not in keeping with the understanding of the text. The text and the custom need to be understood as one unit, just like this text and that text had to be understood as one unit. These commentaries of Rashi and the Tosafists remain the basic staples of Talmudic study up until today. One final element of medieval Ashkenazi religious culture that I want to mention was the development of a group known as Hasidei Ashkenaz, or we'll call them German or Ashkenazi pietists, in the second half of the 12th through the 13th century. This was a small elite movement, small in number but large in influence, that maintained strict standards of religious observance for its members. They lived by their own esoteric and mystical doctrines. They stressed the spiritual efficacy of prayer in particular, and were very much preoccupied with the manifestation of the divine, of the deity in the universe. Their influence also continued, albeit on a much smaller level, more modest level throughout the Middle Ages up until our own day. My last two lectures focused on the Jews of Ashkenaz, Jews living in the Rhineland and France under Christendom. We talked about outside in, the attitude of Christianity towards Jews and Judaism, and we talked about the Crusades, how this practically played itself out in the history of the Jews in the Rhineland in the 11th and 12th centuries, and then also the intellectual life of Ashkenazi Jewry from the inside going out. In my next lecture, I want to turn our attention to Jews living under Islam in the Middle East and in southwestern Europe. And in particular, and relevant to us, to the Jewish-Muslim relationship that existed in the Middle Ages, the significance of which in these days is absolutely self-evident and obvious. Jewish-Christian relations are extremely important. Jewish-Muslim relations are very important, particularly in light of current events. I hope you will join me as we continue this journey. Judaism and Christianity are legitimate guardians of a divinely revealed text. The Hebrew Bible, divinely revealed to Jews. The New Testament, divinely revealed to Christians. So we have already two divinely revealed books, obviously holy. However, Revelation has not been completed. In their view, there's one more step. There's one more revelation that's necessary, and that's the revelation of the Quran to Muhammad.